All right, so tonight we'll pick up in Numbers chapter 15, just as a quick reminder. Last time we were together, we did Numbers chapters 13 and 14, and that was a real pivot point in many respects of the book of Numbers, as well as in the generation of Israelites that was redeemed out of Egyptian slavery in Numbers chapter 14. If you remember, that was when God chose that he would not bring this generation of Israelites into the land that he had promised to Abraham and his descendants. And he did that because we see in Numbers chapter 14, verse 22, that generation had grumbled against him 10 times. And we went through those 10 times, and so that in many ways that 10 in the Bible is a number of completeness, and so God had decided that he had enough with that particular generation of Israelites, though he did promise that their sons and daughters he would bring into the land of Canaan. So that's where we were last time. Tonight, Lord willing, we will get through Numbers chapters 15 through 17. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in Numbers chapter 15. And if you remember back to the introduction to Numbers, in these particular chapters, 15 through 19, these are what we call the undated events. So this generation of Israelites now is going to be in the wilderness 40 years because they chose not to go into the land of Canaan. And so God says that he will leave them in the wilderness for 40 years until that generation falls in the wilderness, and the subsequent generation then is prepared to go into Canaan. So these are the undated events. And so the reason why that's important is because in Numbers chapter 15, you might be asking yourself why there's a revisiting of some of the laws that were to be instituted once the Israelites get to Canaan. And you have to remember, of course, that there's a period of 40 years here. And so it may be that some of them are just for a reminder for Moses and the Israelites. There's not a lot of explanation of that. And so I'm not going to revisit this ground that we have already tread upon. So in Numbers chapter 15, verses 1 through 10, there's a discussion of the burnt and free will offerings, which we have talked about previously, specifically in the book of Leviticus. In verses 11 through 13, it's the continuing of the offerings, and then that flows into verse 14 and following, where God identifies that there ought to be only one law, and that would apply to both the Israelites as well as the sojourners, that is the non-Israelites who chose to come and to marry themselves into the nation of Israel. In verses 17 through 21, a quick summary of the offerings of the first fruits. And then in verses 22, basically through 31, there's this discussion more of offerings. Verse 24 identifies offerings for the congregation. Verse 27, offerings for one single person. And as just a very quick comment in verses 30 and 31, as a reminder, Numbers chapter 15, verses 30 and 31. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord Yahweh, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt shall be on him. So we have seen this before in the Pentateuch, and I think it bears repeating that the only sins that can be forgiven are the sins that are not done in willful defiance of the commands of God, right? And so how would we apply this today, right? I mean, we for example, would provide clear, godly, biblical counsel to a brother and a sister, articulating in no uncertain terms from the Bible that what this person is about to do is to go off and run headlong into sin. And that person chooses to go do that anyway in the context of the local church body, for example. That would be grounds for clear and immediate church discipline. And so it's very important for us to understand that when we get godly biblical counsel from brothers and sisters, and we are convinced in our conscience that it is good and godly and biblical, the stakes very much are raised in that regard. And so let us be committed to obedience to the Lord's commands. In verses 32 and following, I do want to read this brief episode. Verse 32, Numbers chapter 15. "Now while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because it had not been declared what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'The man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp.' So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moses." And so I would just point out here that all the way back, even as far back as Exodus chapter 31, verses 14 and 15, the breaking of the Sabbath was identified as a capital offense. But if you go back into Exodus 31, the methodology or the method of that capital punishment is not laid out. And so that is why Moses then goes to ask the Lord how this capital punishment is to be carried out. And the Lord chooses here to stone the Sabbath breaker to death. And I'm not going to talk a lot about the Sabbath. We have done that several times before in the Pentateuch. But obviously, here in the time of the Mosaic Covenant or the Old Covenant, Sabbath breaking was a very, very serious offense in the nation of Israel. Picking up in verse 37, "The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot, in order that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God.'" And so we see here this prescription for blue tassels on the corners of their garments, specifically here identified as reminders to the Israelites of the commandments of the Lord. And I just want to point out in verse 39, again, "It shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes." And so I would just point out here very briefly, this concept of following your heart is something that is very much at the forefront of our culture. If you listen to popular music or even not so popular music, perhaps, you will get a lot of this messaging that's coming through the speakers, for example. And in fact, I would say that you would probably get it in more than a few so-called churches as well. And so here it's very clear that the Lord is imploring us that we not follow our hearts nor follow our eyes, but we follow his commands. Jeremiah, of course, says that the heart of mankind is desperately wicked. Who can know it? And so it's never, never a good idea to follow your own heart. We ought to be following the Lord's commands, what he tells us in his word. So just a warning for us all there. We'll spend the bulk of this evening on Numbers chapter 16 and 17, specifically Korah's rebellion. Okay, and so we'll pick up in Numbers chapter 16, verse 1. "Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action, and they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" When Moses heard this, he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself, even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself. Do this, take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi." Then Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi, is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them, and that he has brought you near, Korah, and all your brothers, sons of Levi, with you? And are you seeking for the priesthood also? Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. But as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him?" Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, "We will not come up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us? Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not regard their offering. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done harm to any of them." And Moses said to Korah, "You and all your company be present before the Lord tomorrow, both you and they along with Aaron. And each of you take his fire pan and put incense on it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 fire pans. Also you and Aaron shall each bring his fire pan." So they took his own censer and put fire on it, and laid incense on it. And they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Thus Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly." But they fell on their faces and said, "O God, God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation?" Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." Then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram, with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart now from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing that belongs to them, lest you be swept away in all their sin." So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. And Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. If these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord." Then it came about, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, and their households, and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, "The earth may swallow us up." Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. Okay, so this is a relatively long story, obviously, here in the book of Numbers, famously known as Korah's Rebellion. And one thing to note here as to sort of what is the genesis, perhaps, of this rebellion, it should be noted that the tribes of Reuben and Kohath both resided on the south side of the tabernacle. Okay, and so you can see in verse 1 that Korah is a son of Kohath, or the Kohathites, and Dathan and Abiram and On are all sons of Reuben. right? So it may very well be that they were camping next to each other on the south side of the tabernacle, and you know how grumbling goes, and you know how misery loves company, and so perhaps they were feeding off of one another as they were dwelling in their tents on the south side of the tabernacle. And of course, they were able to stir up quite a crowd. Verse 2, there are 250 leaders from the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown, right? And so these are people who could probably whip up a crowd. And in verse 3, you can see the nature of their rebellion. They assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy." And this should ring in our ears a little bit. It's a rebellion similar to the rebellion which we saw a couple of sessions ago with Aaron and Miriam. They were challenging Moses' authority, and here arguing that the entire congregation are holy and there's really nothing so special about Moses. And of course, we know how this is going to end. It will end actually worse than it ended for Aaron and Miriam. Now, the interesting thing here is how Moses pleads with Korah, verse 8. Then Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them?" And so the argument here from Moses, in a sense, is he doesn't understand why someone like Korah would raise himself up against Moses. Korah was a Kohathite. He was a Levite. He was actually blessed more than many of the common Israelites. He was involved in the carrying of the furniture of the tabernacle. So if you go back to Numbers chapter 3, verses 27 to 32, I'm not going to go back there. You can go back there for reference. But you can see that the Kohathites, who are descendants of Levi, are in fact given a special place, a very privileged place among the sons of Israel, that when the Israelites were to set out and carry the tabernacle, the Kohathites were tasked with carrying the very furniture that resided in the tabernacle itself. And so Korah is in no way, shape, or form a common Israelite. And Moses simply asks him in verses 8 and 9, "Is it not enough that you have been granted this high place, frankly, among the Israelites?" And he says in verse 10, "And are you seeking for the priesthood also?" So the Kohathites were not sons of Aaron. Sons of Aaron, of course, were the priests and the high priests. But the Kohathites had a very high place regardless, because they were sons of Levi. But apparently that was not enough for Korah. And I think there's a sense in which we could all learn a lesson from this particular rebellion. And that is we should be reminded that the place that we are in our lives is a place that God has assigned to us. And so in many ways, just battling for contentment in the place where God has assigned us might for some of us be a daily battle. And apparently Korah lost that battle and was looking for a higher place among the Israelites. And then Moses, verse 12, sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram. And these guys are quite hard-headed, as you can see. They say at the end of verse 12, "We will not come up. We will not be summoned by you, Moses." Again, there's nothing special about you, Moses. And then they say even more ridiculous things in verses 13 and 14. And you can see here how bad, frankly, grumbling and complaining can get. So let me read verses 13 and 14 again, because they are very telling about the heart condition of Dathan and Abiram. Verse 13, "Is it not enough," speaking to Moses, "that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us?" The The argument being made here, of course, is that as they think back so fondly on Egyptian slavery, referring to Egypt as a land flowing with milk and honey, and of course those of us who have been moving through the Pentateuch together know that in the early portions of Exodus, that was clearly not the situation that they were in. But again, grumbling is so often devoid of reason and memory. Verse 14, indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. And so what we see here is that Dathan and Abiram, at some point in these undated events in the 40 years during the wilderness wanderings, they have actually forgotten that it was them and their Israelite brothers and sisters and their complaining, which is the reason why they're not in the land of Canaan on that very day. But apparently they have not learned from that particular practice, and here they are doing it again. The very reason that Moses has not brought them into Canaan or given them an inheritance of fields and vineyards is because they are grumblers and they are complainers. It is their very fault for why that has not been the case. I note here in verse 15, Moses became very angry. I just mentioned that to you. If you didn't notice it, it will be important as we move through the rest of Numbers, because we see here that however meek and mild Moses was at times, he also did have a tendency to become angry as well. And we will see that again before this book is out. In verse 20, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation that I may consume them instantly. And so I just note here that God is talking about the entire congregation here, that he's going to wipe them out. We've already seen this before, this interaction between the Lord and Moses. But Moses and Aaron fall on their faces, verse 22, and again intercede for the Israelites. And the question, of course, in verse 22, O God, God of spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation? And of course, the plea here is to God's justice, that he would not condemn and kill all of the Israelites for the sins of about 250 men. And so the Lord here is merciful and he relents. Verse 24, speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Right? So here God is going to separate the Israelites into those who were grumbling and complaining and rebelling from those who were not. And I would also note here that in verse 24, only three of the four names are mentioned, right? So in verse 1, if you go back and look, there were actually four men who were involved originally in the rebellion. There were Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On. And then here in verse 24, only Korah, Dathan, and Abiram are named. And so the Bible is obviously pretty silent on why that is. It may be, in fact, that at some point during this time, this man named On, who is a son of Reuben, perhaps he repented and chose to separate himself from the other three. That would be speculation, but I just note here that in verse 24, that one particular man is not mentioned. And so we see here that God is going to separate the Israelites, those who rebel from those who do not rebel. And now God is going to do this. He's going to bring his judgment and condemnation on Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and these 250 men, and also their families, apparently in a new way, verse 30. Right? Verse 29, if these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, that is, if they die of natural causes, then the Lord has not sent me. 30, but if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. This is the netherworld, the place of the dead, in Hebrew idiom. And so what we see here is verse 31. Of course, this came about as the Lord predicted through Moses. Then it came about, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, and their households, and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. And so this would obviously include not just Korah and the 250 men who came to the tent of the tent of meeting or the tabernacle, but this would have also included the very places where Dathan and Abiram themselves were as well. And so it's very interesting. And I would also note in verse 32 that it wasn't just the men, but it was their households as well. And so just a reminder here of the doctrine of federal headship, right? Those men represented their households, and their households, complete households with the women and children, were also judged for the sins of the federal head of the household, the men. And in verse 33, the earth closed over them. It was as if they had never been there. Verse 34, and all Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, the earth may swallow us up. So there's great fear in the congregation, obviously. And then verse 35, fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. Verse 36, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, that he shall take up the censers out of the midst of the blaze, for they are holy, and you scatter the burning coals abroad. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered sheets for a plating of the altar, since they did present them before the Lord, and they are holy, and they shall be for a sign to the sons of Israel. So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers which the men who were burned had offered, and they hammered them out as a plating for the altar, as a reminder to the sons of Israel that no layman who is not of the descendants of Aaron should come near to burn incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his company, just as the Lord had spoken to him through Moses. So these censers who are left after the men are consumed by the fire of the Lord, which emanates from the tabernacle, these censers are obviously not burned up completely, but now they are clearly purified by the fire of the Lord. They have been touched by the fire of the Lord. And so now they are holy, and they cannot go back to be used for common use. And so God ordains that they should be collected by Eleazar, the priest, the son of Aaron, and they should be hammered out as plating to be put on the bronze altar as a reminder of something that we have already seen here in the Pentateuch, and that is that the only ones who are authorized in the nation of Israel to offer incense to the Lord are the sons of Levi, the priests. And so every time an Israelite went to the bronze altar to offer a sacrifice, they would look at the bronze altar, they would see this additional bronze plating that had been hammered out and fastened to the bronze altar, and they would remember that they were but common people, and the priests were the ones who stood between them and Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. Shockingly, verse 41 and following, but on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, you are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. It came about, however, when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron, that they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly. Then they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, take your censer and put in it fire from the altar and lay incense on it. Then bring it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone forth from the Lord. The plague has begun. Then Aaron took it as Moses had spoken and ran into the midst of the assembly. For behold, the plague had begun among the people. So he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he took his stand between the dead and the living, so that the plague was checked or stopped. But those who died by the plague were 14,700, besides those who died on account of Korah. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, for the plague had been checked. So this is the very next day where Korah and his rebellious cohort and all of their households were destroyed by the Lord for challenging the authority of Moses and Aaron, and now they are grumbling again the very next day. And again, Moses and Aaron fall on their faces. They intercede for the Israelites, but not before almost 15,000 Israelites perish because of this plague of death. And it was stopped by apparently some quick thinking by Moses to give Aaron the censer and incense to stop the plague. Verse 17, or chapter 17, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, and get from them a rod for each father's household, 12 rods, from all their leaders according to their father's households. You shall write each name on his rod, and write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi, for there is one rod for the head of each of their father's households. You shall then deposit them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony where I meet with you. And it will come about that the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel who are grumbling against you." Moses therefore spoke to the sons of Israel, and all their leaders gave him a rod apiece, for each leader according to their father's households, 12 rods, with the rod of Aaron among their rods. So Moses deposited the rods before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. Now it came about on the next day that Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted, and put forth buds, and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Moses then brought out all the rods from the presence of the Lord to all the sons of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me, so that they should not die." Thus Moses did, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. Then the sons of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, "Behold, we perish, we are dying, we are all dying. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely?" So here in Numbers chapter 17, a relatively short chapter, but famous perhaps chapter where Aaron's rod buds with buds of flowers and blossoms and ripe almonds. And of course, this, the reason why number 17 is tied back even to number 16 is because number 16 is where the grumbling of Korah and Dathan and Abiram begin against the authority of Moses and Aaron. And that authority here is validated in Numbers chapter 17 with the budding of Aaron's rod. And so Numbers 16 and 17 come with those bookends. We see here that that rod of Aaron's that budded, it had to be returned to the tent of meeting. It now was also holy. We see that in verse 10. And by Aaron's rod budding and producing ripe almonds, there would have been no doubt in the minds of the Israelites, regardless of when this occurred, whether it was 1 year or 10 years or 35 years after Numbers chapter 14, we do not know. But at this point, God uses this episode as a means by which to reestablish the authority of Moses as the intercessor, and Aaron as the high priest among the people of Israel. And then we see them cry out here at the end of Numbers chapter 17, verse 12. They said, "Behold, we perish, we are dying, we are all dying. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely?" And so we see this as a manifestation, frankly, of the Israelites' fear and perhaps not faith, perhaps some unbelief here, and the realization even that their entire generation is going to fall in the wilderness as God said that they would. And this breeds fear among them. Okay, so that is Korah's rebellion in Numbers 16, as well as the budding of the rod of Aaron in Numbers chapter 17. If you would turn with me, we'll finish up here tonight in the New Testament in the book of Jude. In the book of Jude, which is the last book right before the book of Revelation. Jude is a very short book, one chapter, only 25 verses. Jude is a half-brother of Jesus. And I just want to read for you up to the point that is important for us tonight in Numbers chapter 16. So I'll begin in verse 1. Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who are the called, beloved in God the Father, and kept for Jesus Christ, may mercy and peace and love be multiplied to you. Beloved, verse 3, while I was making every effort to write to you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you, appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith which is once for all delivered to the saints. Verse 4. For certain persons have crept in unnoticed, those who were long beforehand marked out for this condemnation, ungodly persons who turn the grace of our God into licentiousness and deny our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all, that the Lord, after saving a people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe. So this is, of course, a reference to that generation of Israelites who fell in the wilderness before they were able to enter into the land of Canaan. Verse 6. And angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Yet in the same manner, these men, that is the men that are back in verse 4, those are the men to whom he's referring to. In the same manner, these men who have crept in unnoticed, also by dreaming, defile the flesh and reject authority and revile angelic majesties. But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." But these men revile the things which they do not understand, and the things which they know by instinct, like unreasoning animals, by these things they are destroyed. Verse 11, woe to them, that is these false teachers, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the era of Balaam, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. So I'm not going to continue on past there. You can certainly read along the next 14 verses or so for yourself in the short epistle of Jude. But the point here is that Korah and the rebellion which he led in Numbers chapter 16 is used as an example in the New Testament by Jude, the half-brother of Jesus Christ, as an example of the false teachers who, in verse 3, have crept into the church unnoticed, ungodly persons who turn the grace of our God into licentiousness and deny Jesus Christ, right? And so we see that the warnings against false teachers in the church is great and awful. To be honest with you, when you are put in the same category as those who were destroyed in Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities. We have not yet talked about the sins of Balaam the prophet, but we will get there in Numbers. But we see here in Jude verse 11 that the rebellion of Korah is held up as an awful testimony of what will happen to those who are false teachers in the church. And so for those of us who are teachers, this warning is great and awful for us. It reminds us of James chapter 3, verse 1, and the warning there is, let not many of you seek to become teachers, for the judgment will be greater. And so these are the kinds of texts that ought to make us all fearful, that we would not fall into the hands of the living God. At the same time, the expectation of judgment is higher even among those who are false teachers in the church. And so we should read a chapter like Numbers chapter 16, and it should cause us all to be sober as we see God pouring out his wrath on those who rebel against him and his appointed men. So anyway, that is where we were tonight, Numbers 16 and 17. And Lord willing, we will pick up next time in Numbers chapter 18.